The Dual Alliance. Prologue. Barbara Garrettery was 30 and Irish. To the casual observer, the world was a bright-colored ball for her tossing. When she was a tiny mite, her father had dubbed her Bob, son of battle, because of certain obvious, warlike traits of character, and Bob Garrettery she had been ever since. She had literally fought her way to the top, handicapped by poverty, very little education, the responsibility of an invalid and dependent father. She had been forced to make all her own opportunities, but at 30 she was riding the shoulders of the witch success. Her mother, having endowed her only child with the gift of a happy heart, went on her singing way into paradise when Bob was 3. Her father, handsome ne'er-do-well that he was, made a poor and intermittent living for them until the girl was 15. Then poor health overtook him, and Bob took the helm. At 15 she worked on a newspaper, and discovered she had a picturesque talent for words. Literary ambition gripped her, a desire to make permanent use of the dramatic elements which she uncovered in her rounds of assignments. She had a nose for news and made a fair success, until she took to sitting up at night to write real stuff, as she called it. Her nervous, high-strung temperament would not stand the strain, so, true to her Irish blood, she gave up the newspaper job, with its Saturday night pay envelope, and threw herself headlong into the uncharted sea of authorship. She began with short stories for magazines. Editors admitted her, responded to her personality, returned her tales. "If you could write the way you talk," they all said. Now Daddy Garrettery had to eat, no matter how light she could go on rations, so she abandoned literature shortly for a position in a decorator's shop. Here, too, she found charm an asset. She worked 8 hours a day, cooked for 2 of them, washed, sewed, took care of her invalid, lavished herself upon him, then wrote at night, undaunted by her first failure. She used her brain on the problem of success. When the manager of the shop put her in charge of their booth at the Arts and Crafts exhibition, because, as he said, you can attract people, she recalled the consensus of editorial opinion, and made up her mind that personality was her real gift. The stage was the show window for that possession, so thither she turned her face at 18, and in due course of time joined the great army which follows the mirage of stage success. But Bob proved to be one of the gods anointed, and from the first the charm of her queer, haunting face, which some found ugly and some proclaimed beautiful, marked her for advance. She was radiantly happy in the work, and happier still that she was able to provide more comforts and luxuries for Daddy, who was her idol. The real crux of her ambition was the day when she could give him everything his luxury-loving heart desired. She worked hard, she learned the trade of the theater. She studied her audiences, noted their likes and dislikes, what they laughed at, and when they wept. Then once again she took up her abandoned pen and began to work on a play. She and Daddy talked it, played it, mulled it over every waking hour for months. Then one historic day Bob read it to an audience of Daddy and a manager. That was the beginning of the last lap of the race. The manager accepted it and left father and daughter in a state of ecstasy. "Well, Dad, it looks like the real thing this time." "It does, Bobsy. You're not only the prettiest Garrettery, but you're the smartest of the clan. Blarney. I wish your mither could see ye the day. Ye were such a queer mite, but smart, ye were always smart. What'll I buy ye with our fortune, Daddy? A farm in the old country and little pigs?" "No pigs for me. I'd like me a body servant and brass buttons to wait on me no night and day. When I come down our marble stairs, I want to see him stand in there, attention, so I can say, 'Jimmy, there's your valley.' You funny old dad. What else? We'll get us a motor car." "Sure, and a country place, but no pigs. How about a yacht?" "We'll stay on land, my vornin, 'tis safer. But we must go to Europe, cabin deluxe." "I don't care if it's deluxe, if it's de-comfortable," he laughed. This was the beginning of a wonderful game of make-believe, which they played for months. Bob's comedy went into rehearsal at once, and every day when she came home, after hours spent in the theater, she found Daddy laughing over some new scheme he had devised for spending their fortune, when it came. They planned like Mahia with the magic carpet in their hands, ready to spread before them. They worked out tours of Europe, they built and rebuilt their country house. They endowed charities for newspaper writers and interior decorators, they planned a retreat for indigent magazine writers and an asylum for editors. Life was a joyous thing, stretching out ahead of them, full of color and success, and then, on the very eve of the production of Bob's play, Daddy died. Bob went through it all, the first night and what came after, like a wraith. The adulation and the praise that came to her were ashes instead of fire. 6 years followed of success. Money, travel, friends, the love and admiration of great audiences came to her, but Bob found life stale. Lovers came aplenty, she made them friends and kept them, or sent them on their way. Bob had everything the world's wife wants, and in her own heart she knew she had nothing. Generosity was her vice. Anybody in her profession, or out of it, who was in trouble, had only to go to Bob Garratry for comfort or for cash. There was usually a tired, discouraged girl recuperating out at Bob's bungalow, and in the summertime all the stage children she could find came to pay her visits and live on real milk and eggs. She interested herself in the girls' student colonies in New York, and became their patron saint. She found that the girls in the Three Arts Club, and kindred student places, getting their musical and dramatic education with great sacrifice usually, either to their parents or themselves, had only such opportunities to hear the great artists of the day as the top galleries afforded. The dramatic students fared better than the others, she found, for they could get seats for 25 or 50 cents in the lofts of theaters, but the music students had to stand in line sometimes for 2 or 3 hours to buy a place in the gallery of the Metropolitan. As it was impossible to see anything from there, seated, they were accustomed to stand through the entire opera. For this privilege they paid $1. Bob learned what that dollar meant to most of them, an actual sacrifice, even privation. While rich patrons yawned below, these young idealists, the musical and dramatic hope of our future, leaned over the railing, up under the roof, trying to grasp the fine shades of expression which mark the finished artist. All this Bob Garratry learned, and raged at. She herself donated 25 student seats for every opera, and a lesser number for each good play. She interested some of her friends in the idea. With characteristic fervor she adopted all the students in New York, but even this large family did not fill the nooks and crannies of her empty heart. You felt it in her work, the Celtic Minor, as one critic said. Possibly Paul Trent expressed it best when he said, "Behind her every laugh you feel her tree in her weird." "Part I Mr. Trent Mississippi Garratry is on the wire," said the stenographer to Trent, who sat at his desk making inroads on the piles of correspondence, official documents, and typewritten evidence which heaped his desk. "I told you I couldn't be interrupted," he replied sharply. "I explained that to her, when she called the first time. She says that if you don't speak to her she will come down here." He smiled reluctantly as he took up the receiver. "Good morning," he said. "What is the use of having a lawyer, if he acts like a Broadway manager?" she asked. "I wish you could see the pile of papers completely surrounding me," he answered. "I'm not interested in your troubles, I want mine attended to." "Entirely feminine." "Yes, it is selfish." "I said feminine." "I heard you. I want you to lunch with me at 2. "I cannot possibly do it," he interrupted her. "It isn't social, it is business, and it must be attended to today." "I'm sorry, but..." "Mr. Trent, I assure you it is a matter of serious importance. I feel justified in insisting upon your professional attention for 1 hour today. If you prefer, I will come to you." Trent's face showed his annoyance. "I cannot take time for lunch. I'll be there at 3.
"Thank you."
He hung up the receiver impatiently and returned to his work. A few minutes before 3 he set out for the hotel where Barbara Garratry lived. He was annoyed at himself for coming, probably some foolishness which could just as well be attended to over the telephone. He knew the actress only slightly. He had acted as her attorney in 1 or 2 minor cases when she needed legal help. He had found her sensible and intelligent, for a woman. Susceptible to beauty, he had felt her charm, and even promised himself that someday he would take time to know her. She interested him, because all successful people interested him. It was his only measure. At 40 he found himself envied by men, his seniors in his profession. He had served as state's attorney, he was on the eve of trying for a bigger prize, but today, as he made his way along the crowded street, in answer to Barbara Garratry's summons, his mood was a bit cynical. Life held no locked doors for him, he had peered behind them all, as father confessor. Men he found open books, women, thin volumes not worth the reading. Today he had a sense of isolation from his fellows, a wave of loneliness, almost futility. This average man, who passed him on the street, had his home, his wife, and children to match with Trent's bigger issues. He was invited to Miss Garratry's sitting room at once. Her maid admitted him, and she came to greet him. He was struck again with a certain poignant quality in her, although her smile was merry. "I know how furious you are at having to come. On the contrary, I am honored. You are unremittingly courteous, considering that you are you. Which means, I know in what poor esteem you hold women, she smiled. You do me a great injustice, he began. You do yourself one, she interrupted. We're not so bad. However, the fact that we interest you so little makes it possible for you to do me a service. I am glad. She waved him to a seat, and as she crossed the room he found himself wondering whether her floating gown was blue or violet or both. The primroses at her belt gave him pleasure. She gathered up some papers and laid them before him. I wish to make my will. This is a list of my possessions and the distribution I wish made of them. He looked over the list, his eye appraising with surprise her investments. You have been very successful. Yes. You wish me to have this typed, signed, witnessed, and filed with your other papers? If you please. I wish my body cremated and the ashes thrown into the sea, she added quietly. He glanced at her quickly. You are ill? You are afraid of death? Afraid of death? No, I am seeking it. What do you mean? I mean I do not wish to live anymore, I'm tired. He looked about him at the charming, flower-scented room, at the vibrant figure of the girl. You mean you intend to end it, deliberately? Yes. Why not? There is not a living soul dependent on me to be affected by my going. You don't think it's cowardice? I'm brave enough to be a coward. I've fought my way through and over every obstacle, even you say I've been successful. Now I'm tired, I've got nothing to fight for, I'm Irish, and I'm lonesome. But you're just at the top, ready to enjoy what you've fought for. There's nothing in that. It's only the fight that counts. He understood that. Why don't you marry, or have you? No, I have not. I don't want money or position. I can't marry a man who loves me when I'm only fond of him. I'd rather marry a stranger. What made you begin the fight? I wanted things for Daddy, and he died just before I won out. Why don't you interest yourself in some cause? Women nowadays are. Suffrage or charity? The Irish are never satisfied with causes, man. There's home rule, he smiled. The women have it, she retorted. But it's ridiculous. Why, you've got everything in the world. Do you think that? She challenged him directly. He walked over to the window and looked out at the early winter sunset. Presently he came back and faced her. No, he answered. She nodded. I've thought it all out. I think I have the right. I'm at the top of my wave now, I don't want to sink slowly down into the trough of old age and mediocrity. I'm going. When? She laughed. Oh, the day of execution isn't set. I want to get my house in order. How are you going? I don't know. They're all rather ugly. I wanted you to have directions. I want you sent for. Why did you select me? Curiously. Because I thought you would understand. He walked up and down the room, his tall head bent, his eyes on the floor. She watched him absently, her mind far away. He roused her by stopping before her. I do understand. I offer no opposition. You're of age, you know what you want. I make you a counter-proposition. We will call a taxi, go to the courthouse, get a license and be married. We will spend 6 months together, as partners only. We each go on with our own work, but we share our problems and our pleasures. At the end of the 6 months, if you still want to go, I'll help you. She stared at him, utterly aghast. But I hardly know you. You said you'd rather marry a stranger than a man you were merely fond of, so would I. I've felt this loneliness you speak of. I'd like to make this experiment. We are neither of us handicapped by sentiment, we start even. But you don't like me, much. Enough. As well as you like me. You're a good gambler. Get your hat and come along. 6 months. What difference will it make in 1,000 years? She questioned. None. She stood on tiptoe, her two hands on his shoulders, and looked long into his eyes. He looked into hers frankly. In the end she nodded, went into the other room, came back at once, in hat and furs. It's a new kind of suicide, she smiled, come on. 2. In the cab a sort of terror of this madness came upon Bob. She glanced at this strange man beside her as if she had never seen him before. His handsome, aquiline profile was toward her as he gazed at the crowds passing. What was in his mind? Was he, too, longing to run? It's getting colder. People are scurrying, he said casually. She steadied at his calm tone. A new courage, a new sense of adventure began to stir in her. They said very little on the drive, in fact, except for necessary questions they were almost entirely silent until they walked out of the courthouse, man and wife. Trent put her into the cab, gave an order, and got in after her. She looked at him intently, so much depended on these first few minutes. "Well, partner," he smiled, and took her gloved hand in a firm clasp for a minute.